previously on Something Who.
Welcome to the podcast where we take something old, a Doctor Who story from the original series, compare it with something new, one from the new series, and add something borrowed to make Something Who'd. Hello, I'm Richard, and we're back with Something Who podcast, where this time we're looking at two stories involving those bald-headed near-neighbours from the spheres. Initially, we'll look at First Doctor story, The Sensorites, from Season 1, and later we'll examine 10th Doctor adventure, Planet of the Ood, from Series 4. And with me to decide whether these stories are sensational or have left us feeling a bit sensitive, I have a star-studded panel, starting with Something Who's own science correspondent, Giles. So, hello, Giles.
Evening.
And back for a third time, it's Lego modeler and 2024's podcast breakout sensation, Rick.
Well, good evening, everybody. Lovely to be back.
Great. We missed him beyond measure, but finally back in our ranks is the multi-talented 3D artist, writer, researcher, podcaster, and co-creator of Dalek 63-88. It's Gav Rymill.
Hooray! Hey, I'm back.
Yeah.
Lucky people.
Yeah. And since it's that time of the year again, making his annual special guest appearance, it's Missing Episodes podcaster and celluloid aficionado, Tim.
Good evening, everyone. Hello.
Splendid. I mean, I dream about having a panel of this quality. So it's lovely to see you all. So, this was Planet of the Ood, written by Keith Temple and directed by Graham Harper. I mean, I've got nothing original to say about what I've done with this, and because inevitably I watched it in 2008, haven't watched it since until last weekend, and enjoyed it. Anyway, over to the rest of you to say something original.
Well, that's it for originality, eh? Watched it on broadcast, watched it now and again since then.
When I saw this originally, it was still in the absolute fever period of loving the new series, and I was extremely excited about it. I personally think Series 4 might overall be my favourite. I think all the Catherine Tate performances are a great addition. I might need to watch it all through again from the start because, I don't know, I didn't love her quite as much watching this as I thought I did. Mm-hmm. But it's a great piece of television. Mm-hmm. Good night.
Mic drop.
I watched it on transmission and I've watched it on and off since on my various having it on around the flat while I'm doing things. And the first time I watched it, I thought it was fine, but distinctly middling. Mm-hmm. Giles.
Oh, okay. Right. I thought there was going to be a punchline to that.
No,
I'm
going to slowly reveal my current feelings towards it as we discuss.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Also, probably haven't watched it since transmission. I don't know. In season 4, I don't. It's not that I didn't enjoy it at the time, but my general feeling about season 4 was after I really, really enjoyed season 3, series 3, and then I kind of felt like I could tell they were firing on all cylinders and everything made sense, but it didn't quite, series 4 didn't quite do it for me. I sort of felt like it was coasting a little bit on its laurels, so maybe I haven't revisited it as much as some of the earlier stuff.
Can I interject and ask you a question, Giles?
Mm.
On a recent podcast, you mentioned you described Daleks in Manhattan as being more of a filler story because it didn't. I can't quite remember what you said, but you said something like it didn't contribute to the overall arc or direction that the season was heading in. And I'm curious because you didn't expand on that thought. So I have no idea what qualifies a story in season three as in or out of that arc. Because I was trying to think, like, how is it different to Gridlock or the Shakespeare Code or the Sontaran one? What qualities... Sorry, not so. Forget Sontaran. I've just seen the trailer for it because it was on the tag on the end of that.
Now you're forgiven.
But
to stand up my opinions.
So I didn't know what the arc story was that you were alluding to that you thought Daleks in Manhattan didn't fit into, but something else did.
Well, I just feel like there's bits of stuff I know. I have an unusual opinion about Shakespeare Code, which is that I think there's foreshadowing of the Archangel Network in there with what they do with the with what they're doing with the multi-sided globe. That may be reading too much into it, admittedly. That's not like Doctor Who fans ever. Gridlock has obviously sees the whole Yana thing. Then you've got the Lazarus experiment and 42, and they obviously do stuff that is, well, they're standalones, but they seed stuff to do with Martha's family, and they sort of drip the mystery of Mr. Saxon a bit into things. And then obviously once you get into the back six, everything is kind of connected anyway, because you got the Fog Watch and then, yeah, all of that stuff.
I do kind of feel watching season three, which, like Giles, I adore. And I also adore Gridlock, which I know a lot of people name as a clunker. But I find watching season three that I'm waiting for the Dalek ones to be got out of the way. And then I can get on with the season. I think season three is the absolute peak of Doctor Who. That last run leading up to the finale, which I exclude from that. I think it's brilliant TV. And that carries over to season four as well. It's exceptionally strong.
Hmm.
What was the season four opener?
Partners in Crime.
Partners in Crime.
So that's a fun season opener, which kind of not as successfully, but the opener for season three, Smith and Jones, it does the same sort of job.
Mm-hmm.
Very light, entertaining. And then Fires of Pompeii is a zinger. And then this one, I previously had discounted, but have a different view now. I shade towards preferring season three. I think that's brilliant, but I think season four is fantastic too. Again, the very final end of it, but I think three and four combined is extremely good TV. I think it's Doctor Who to wear on your sleeve. And at the time, you know, have you ever watched Doctor Who? Here you are, watch some of season three, and it would hook people in. But yeah, I don't know. I don't enjoy the Dalek two-parter, I'm afraid. It's in the way. It's Daleks for the sake of Daleks for me.
Yeah, interesting. I'm just looking at episode lists.
I feel a little bit like that about the Sontaran two-parter.
And me too, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I feel more probably that about the Sontaran two-parter just because it, you know, having revisited the Dalek one recently and you know, like it a bit better the second time round. So yeah, I guess I probably need to watch the Sontaran one again to sort of see how I feel about it now. But the Sontaran one has that kind of slight CBBC feel about it, I think.
Yeah.
I may be maligning it, but it doesn't feel quite as, yeah, anyway.
That said, Rick did a great job of making me think about reconsidering and rewatching to sort of pick out things which I would have not necessarily honed in on before. Not noticed, but, you know, just focus on various little things going on.
Mm.
But yeah.
As with most of these things, we do tend to find there's more interesting stuff to pick out on rewatching. And
yeah.
One trope of Something Who, which has been said often, I'm afraid, to say, is that when you go back and watch what was felt to be a filler episode at the time, turns out to be bloody good. And I felt very much like this now, because I wasn't wrapped up in a season arc, and I wasn't that impressed with the Ood because I'd just seen the end of season three, and I thought that was the best TV possible.
Mm.
And I did a little Twitter poll before coming on, just to see if my feelings about Planet of the Ood were mirrored. So I just asked, you know, how did you rate Planet of the Ood when you watched it at the time? Top tier, bit of a filler or a miss? And 107 votes, 61% said a bit of a filler.
Okay.
So if anyone took part in that poll, go back and watch Planet of the Ood, because I think it stands up better.
Yeah.
When it's not in the midst of all this dynamite Doctor Who that's going on. But I found it really enjoyable this time. I don't have any issues with it at all. I've got plenty to sing about. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that very much echoes my thoughts about it at the time. Was, I remember it as being okay, but it didn't really stand out. One thing I did notice this time watching it was how fast the titles come up. I mean, we've got used to watching a few Moffaty ones of late on Something Who, and they, you know, often get 2 or 3, even 4 minutes of pre-credits, all sorts of elaborate stuff happening with this. It's all that you need, but it's very quick. It goes, you know, it's in and out.
It's all that you need.
Yes.
It does the job.
Yes.
It says the Oods are turning on people. Yeah. And then what really caught me, because I don't rewatch Modern Who that often, was the pace and the dynamism of the title music.
Yeah.
God, I enjoyed it. I thought, yeah, we're off.
Yeah.
I've not had that since this version of the TV theme, sadly. Because
Series 4 is my favourite.
I think it's never better. I'd agree.
Yeah. And I just felt immediately thrown into an exciting adventure, which I don't get personally these days. I feel I'm going to be wading into a continuity-heavy, overly earnest adventure. But I just think that this season 3 and 4 absolutely were on the money, and I just felt such warmth going back to this. And feeling that thing where, yeah, we're into it. And then that terrific music. And then a story which has a message, but the message is allegorical. It isn't spelled out. There was a certain point in a Capaldi episode where he literally said, "Ah, capitalism!" And from that point on, every single moral in the storytelling has been absolutely spelled out. Now, I don't know whether that's a necessity because of a perception about modern audiences or what, but there was an allegory here. It was nicely undercut with humour at times.
It's not particularly subtle, though, is it?
No, it's not subtle, but it's not literally spelled out. It's just showing it. And then it's nicely undercut. Like, there's a bit where Donna's going off at the baddie, going on, they've got brains in their hands. And then it's just nicely undercut by Tennant going, "Oh, well said," or something like that, you know. No, it's not subtle. I'm not saying
it's subtle.
But
there is a bit where she says, "Oh, I don't have slavery in my time." And he says, "Who do you think made your clothes?"
I missed that. But I didn't feel it's as belaboured as it is now. That was my takeaway. I was just enjoying it for what it was. And I felt that there was enough comedy in there. I thought Tim McInerney was brilliant.
How do you say his name, Tim?
McInerney.
Is that right?
Yeah. Okay. Why are you asking?
Just wondered.
I always used to think it was McInerney, but
so did I.
Everyone did.
Okay, right.
We all did.
What was that about then?
We've all said Tim McInerney for 30 years.
Yeah.
Okay,
and then we got Mandela affected, and somebody changed it into McInerney.
I watched Blackadder to death. I watched those double VHSs to death in the
starring Tim McInerney. Yes,
and it was Tim McInerney.
Yeah, fact.
Well, see, what you're saying is that the third N was never in the name. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and then it's got Mandela into it, and now we just look stupid.
Right.
But, yeah, I just loved it. I really enjoyed it. I thought it had the right balance of everything. I thought it had the right balance of action. And you note that when David Tennant's running at something or running away from something, he's really doing it. And then you forgive everything else because you are sold by the actor's performance. I thought the comedy was right. I liked all of the corporate stuff as well, you know, the woman who's there trying to rescue everything by saying, "Oh, it's an unexpected fire alarm," or whatever. I thought that was all beautifully done. I don't know how much of it was written by Keith Temple or RTD, but I just felt watching it this washed over with warmth and nostalgia for a TV show which is absolutely at its height and a sort of cultural phenomenon. Because it was back then, you know, you had toys in every single shop, floor to ceiling, great viewing figures, great performances, nicely written stories that are more, if you like, I think more allegorical than they are now. Yeah, I really loved it.
What I like about it is because they're on location to film it, you know, you get the real kind of sense of it being an industrial complex. And it kind of gives off Season 7 vibes in that regard. It feels like it's the place that it's pretending to be.
I think at the time that felt cheap to me, because it wasn't in constructed studios. It felt like they picked an obvious location. Hmm. But this time I thought it was, yeah, just fine.
Hmm. I really like the big twisty turny thing.
It has a huge slice of 1970s Doctor Who to it.
Hmm.
And I don't like it to be nostalgic about that. I think it's terrific as modern Doctor Who. But as a tribute to the 70s, even the title, Planet Of, does it for me.
Yeah.
It's got the enslaved alien race. It's got a chemical plant setting. It's got corporate comeuppance. And it has a very Havoc-style fight sequence at one point in the story. So there is a wave of nostalgia that you kind of have for old-school Doctor Who when you're watching this.
Mm.
But as we've just been saying, it's done in a really modern way. It zips. It zips through the opening teaser, zips through the theme music, and it just keeps going, which is fantastic.
Mm. So Graham Harper was directing this after The Unicorn and the Wasp, because I've forgotten he directed this.
Same, I know.
It's a flashback to... Because sometimes I feel like with the Cybermen stories that he directed don't feel terribly like he's a standout from amongst, in the way that he was in the classic series, standout from the other directors. It feels like he sort of merges in with everyone else as kind of, the new generation have raised their game and are on a par. And then watching this, I was thinking, bloody hell, okay, this is good, and this is like elevated in the same way. It manages to get that oomph to it that reminds me of the effect of watching a Graham Harper series in the directed episode in the classic series.
Yes, I think the way they move through the ice planet landscape is wonderfully composed as shots. There's lots of shots that are through snow and through flames. There's a real texture to the visual imagery that you're seeing. The shootout scene is wonderfully dynamic. It's really zips off the screen at you. So again, for me, this was visually so easy on the eye. Graham Harper and others will take huge credit for that.
It's a rare chance to see a vista of an alien planet as well, which was really nice. I mean, we'll forgive the Voyager 2 photos of Saturn in the background in the sky, but the ice, the rock bridge covered in ice, and all of the sweeping landscape shots, really beautifully done with depth and movement, and really sells the idea of being... Because Doctor Who surprisingly infrequently goes and wanders about on alien planets. It tends to be a bit restricted in its view. Either we get we're instantly dumped into an alien city or an underground
cavern
or a base, or it's just an unadulterated quarry. So to get a big beautiful landscape with planets in the sky, ringed planets in the sky, and unusual geological features was really nice.
And we still hadn't had that many alien planets I remember the ridiculous arguments on Gallybase or Outpost Gallifrey, as it probably was back then, about, when are they going to go to an alien planet? And New Earth didn't count because that was somehow meant to be, that was an allegory of Earth. The Satan Pit didn't count because that was an asteroid. I'm trying to think where else they'd... And then, space stations didn't count, et cetera, et cetera. And there were various reasons why things didn't count. And I'm trying to think how... Were other many in series three? I suppose there's Utopia. Well, not Utopia, but the planet they're on in Utopia. But yeah, it is very well executed, and it does look, yeah, does look great.
It's kind of its era as well, in that you've got the thing about the translator ball options, and I don't know whether that's sat navs or ringtones, but sort of in that kind of era, customizing your gadget with a particular voice or sound or whatever was all the rage.
Yeah, it does what Doctor Who needs to do to keep all ages engaged, which is, despite the fact, what are we in, 4126, you know, on an alien planet with this great spaceship flying overhead. It's all people in suits. It's very familiar cargo containers. It's very obviously 20th century chemical plant. There's the Andy Warhol style art on the wall. There's lots of things that actually are very
nice touch. That I think
our world about it.
I was disappointed when they mentioned 4126 because they've censored it as 28th century. Because when that rocket flew over the top,
yes.
I thought, wow, they've even got the same. You know, they've lent into it to the point that they have the same style of rocket ship that they had in the Centaurites.
Yeah.
And then they put a 1,000-year gap in between the two. So
there's talk of three galaxies in this. They kind of look a bit close together.
They do.
Satellite galaxies.
Right.
Next.
Yes. They have to be. It's the only way you can make it make sense. Yeah.
They were tied together with red rope. So probably kept them together for a bit longer.
Yeah.
When we talked about the Sensorites, one of the things that we picked out as a theme was how reflective the opening of the story was from a production point of view. I think Planet of the Ood, again, written by Keith Temple, but I think a strong hand by RTD. He's proving to be very reflective here around the treatment of the Ood by him as a writer in Impossible Planet and the Satan Pit, and looking to perhaps right some of those wrongs in terms of the disposability of the Ood in that story and their portrayal as being a slave race, and correcting some of those within Planet of the Ood. And when I look at some of the material that came out in the specials recently, it seems to be a theme for Russell T. Davis that he wants to revisit things that he felt didn't quite go on reflection how he wanted them to in terms of his writing, put those things right. And the whole Dr. Donna memory wipe thing is put right in the Star Beast. He's played around with the Toy Maker and Davros in recent times. But I think the Ood is one where I can see there was definitely room for him to go and revisit it and say, okay, my view of it and how he projected his view of it onto the 10th Doctor in Impossible Planet and Satan Pit needed some correcting, needed some additional context for it to sit well in his mind. And I'm interested by that dynamic and by that choice to revisit it. It's not revisiting it for the sake of here's a returning alien race that you all liked. There's a real purpose to what he's trying to do here. And I don't know whether other people felt that way about returning to the kind of Ood world building.
I think that's a really great point. I think that's a really interesting point because it's quite an unusual returner, which superficially probably led to, at the time, in the context of all these fireworks going off either side of it, it seemed rather a low-key returner. But when you've contextualised it like that, I think that's probably correct. And he does a great job with it as well. I love the idea that they're born with the brains in their hands. It's quite macabre, isn't it? Yeah, no, really great point.
Yeah.
Great point.
Solana, the PR person who
I
really enjoyed watching in this episode, she describes the Ood as a reflection of us. And that, for me, is the statement for the tone of the episode. What is our view of our relationship with the Ood saying about us? And that brings us to what Gav was saying, Donna reflecting on contemporary slavery being the clothes that she has on, the Doctor reflecting on not having done enough to save the Ood in the previous encounter. It's all wrapped up in there. And I think for us as viewers, we have some reflecting to do. Is, are they just a fun, disposable alien in Doctor Who that looks like you're eating spaghetti badly and create some suspense by chanting out the words of the bigger villain? Or are we prepared to look at them as being a society with greater depth? And this is an episode that brings out that greater depth in a really great way.
Yes, but I didn't particularly care about them myself, having seen them in the previous two-parter, you know? So, like you say, I think when you say it must have lived with Russell, I think that must be correct. Because I wasn't particularly bothered about, you know, their status as indentured servants or slaves or whatever in the original two-parter. But what I find interesting then is that's all very wholesome and great and sounds right. Where the slight misalignment comes is in the denouement, where they ended up turning Tim, let's just call him McInnery, so everyone knows who we are, yeah, turning him into a nood. And that feels slightly at odds with the wholesomeness of what you just described, you know, because they've had their salvation.
Mm-hmm.
And then here's a nasty bit of horrible revenge. I was the first time I watched that, I was really, no, it's not. It is. And this time, I felt slightly more horrified by it, if I'm honest, and found myself more sympathetic to McInnery's character. And it doesn't quite gel for me. I don't know. What do people think of that gut punch at the end?
Sigma's been doing it for a long time. It's been a very long played out gameplay. Yeah. It's not like it's that they, you know, they decide to wreak their revenge afterwards. I guess
true. Yes, but in terms of just the plotting, you know, it's boom.
Yeah, but I guess if you want to, and they don't really lean into that thing about if the idea is that the Uhura reflection of the society, then there's something to be said for the walk a mile in our shoes, kind of thing. But it doesn't really lean into.
Tell me if I missed something. I don't know why they turned him into a nude at the end.
Exactly.
Was it just for a laugh?
Is the idea behind this that they're slowly turning him into a nude so that he's going to set them free because he's the guy that's in charge? But as it so happens, they end up being freed slightly before the plan works its way to its conclusion because it's been a long game.
Maybe, but surely his function as a member of that company with all the relevant authority and human face will be gone the minute he's a nude. So how effectively can he liberate them?
Unless he just breaks the circle briefly once that's happened.
But his henchman was doing that anyway.
That's true.
The Friends of the Ood guy was in the right place at the right time to effect a much better plan than a long-term hair tonic face transformation.
Did the Ood know about the Friends of the Ood?
Pass
indeed.
I think we might allow the transformation of Mr. Halpin as being really good Saturday tea time telly.
So it's more of a sort of Brothers Grimm type thing than perhaps, you know, it's like a sort of the ultimate, you know, come up. I mean, I guess the thing we've got to think about is what actually happens to him afterwards. Is becoming a nude a good thing because he can go and sing with his mates and you know, enjoy life on the planet rather than all that horrible corporate stuff he's been having to put up with for the last goodness knows how long because he's been sort of born into the company? Or yeah, is it horrific because he's still trying as a human to, you know, win at capitalism, but now he's in the body of a nude? I don't know. It kind of depends how you look at it.
I like the long game idea. That almost worked. You've got this Ood in this helpless situation, and he can see that all he can do within his power is exploit a vanity, substitute out the hair tonic, if that's, we have to suppose that's what's happened. And then he's playing the long game because that's all he can do, and if he does it for so long then he'll win. But at the end that doesn't quite marry up with what he says, you know. He is now Ood kind, we will look after him. There's no I did all that, you know, so that he would free us. And I'm not sure how convincingly McInerney as an ood walking round would be able to be effective in unlocking all the gates and, you know, freeing people, because he's an ood. So I'd like the long game idea. I think it's nearly there, but that's not reflected in what happens. So I'm defaulting to Rick's and Gav's answers, which was he was just doing it for a laugh, and it was good. It was good.
Got the novelization around somewhere. I should have read it beforehand.
Because I think, well, because I'm there, it doesn't quite jar with the wholesomeness of everything that's gone before.
Mm.
So what we're saying is Ood Sigma is kind of like the city administrator. He's got motives to want a bit of revenge, and just he's a darker Ood than some of the other Oods.
He's trolling. He's the censorite that comes up at the window, knowing full well that they're already on board.
Yeah.
I did watch The Confidential.
Right.
Related to us. And the scene where Halpin chucks the friend of the Ood, his chief scientist, into the big brain, it's inferred that that needs to occur to elevate Mr. Halpin into true villainous state.
Right.
So that act of revenge, of turning him into an ood, would somehow be justified. And I wonder though, how much villainy needed topping up.
How much worse does he have to get?
Yeah. So, okay, he's been born into this family business, but this is a family business that has mutilated oods into servitude and slavery. And in the period of time that we're privy to his actions, is prepared to use gas chambers and commit genocide.
Mm.
And, you know, you want an allegory, there's one for you. He's an ultimate villain. He's not even passive. He's the one who's barking out these termination orders at the end. As villains go, although he's only in one episode, he's pretty high up my list of most villainous Doctor Who villains, really, you know. He is the baddest of the bad. And so whether it's fitting or not that he gets turned into an ood, there's a large proportion of me wanted him dealt with in one way or another. Mm.
But I think there was a little jarring moment for me, because he's so cartoon villain, and because he's so obviously channeling all of those things, you know, slavery and the Holocaust, etc. There's a little moment where he has a sympathetic moment to Sigma,
yeah,
where he says, "Loyal to the last, go and join your mates." I found that really odd. I don't think that worked.
He's sending you
off to die anyway, which is a bit.
Yeah.
Yes, he is, but
he was making a gesture that was completely hollow.
Yeah. Which then Confidential reveals he then has to, I choose my words advisedly, toss his mate off the balcony. To up his villainy again, to then give a superficial justification.
Yeah, I mean, so how much do we think that the slave trade was in the public consciousness in 2008? I mean, it's definitely very much a thing that we're thinking about now. I mean, look, there was Roots on the telly in the 70s, so it's not like it wasn't a thing that people knew about, but I certainly don't remember it being that big a deal at school. It wasn't taught in the same way that it has been to my daughter in the last sort of 5 or 10 years.
No, it wasn't.
No, I think the good thing about this story is it's more about casual slavery, contemporary casual slavery. It's the idea that you get lulled into accepting that even under our sophisticated, modern, kind, ethical type of environment that some of us may think we live in, it's there, and don't be fooled by it. So,
yeah, it's about not asking questions rather than being a slave owner, isn't it?
Right.
And it's not just the Donna reflection. It's that point where Solana, the Doctor, gives her the choice to break away from that world of corporate indifference and make an ethical stand and make a difference in that situation.
Yeah.
And there she is with this fantastic presence, you know, mulling over what her choice should be. And it gives us the opportunity as the viewer to say, well, which side of the line are we going to stand on? And then in many ways, she betrays us all by saying,
yeah,
let's call over the guards. I'm gonna stick with my pension plan and my ethical blindness and continue on.
I'd say that's the best moment of the episode is her, the bait and switch of her not doing what you think you think she's going to redeem herself, because it would be the right thing to do.
Doctor Who story.
Yes, because it's a Doctor Who story. And then she sells them out. It's a really nice moment.
Yeah. See, I would contend that because there are all of these readings, interpretations that you can do for it and enjoy how the characters go on their own journey on it, I think that's a far more enjoyable and mature and enlightening way of doing it than I suggest they've done more recently. Where you're going to do Rosa Parks and you're going to have a space racist, or you're going to have capitalists, bad capitalists in space, and Capaldi's going to say to the camera, ah, capitalism. You know, I just find it a more rewarding watch. Not in a take it or leave it way, but in a sort of, we're going to entertain you and then try and thread through a wholesome message. I just find that more enjoyable. And you can watch it on any level you wish, therefore. Yeah, I think it was a really great watch. I just think everything was nailed on, really.
I know you're going to say it's interesting that with that bit about when the doctor says, "Oh, who do you think made your clothes?" It's interesting that Donna's reaction. She doesn't reflect. She actually has a pop at Tennant for saying, "Oh, just this way you drag a human around so you can one up them and feel superior to us." Which is quite a nice, because this comes straight out of Pfizer Pompeii. I'm trying to remember, given that this focuses on, she's sort of calling out slavery in this context, I'm trying to think, are there even any slave characters in Pfizer Pompeii?
No, I don't think so.
It's got so much else going on that I guess it's... I know I've just been reading the Lindsay Davis Falco and Flavia Albia novels of late, which are detective stories set in late first century Rome.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I was just reading one that was called Enemies at Home, which is kind of all about the condition of the slaves.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite interesting. But yeah, I guess they didn't really have much room to address that one there.
Another thing I like, though, about that conversation where Donna turns on the doctor and says, is this what you do? You bring a human along to point these things out. For me, that pairs with a conversation they have later on in the episode where Donna claims that she can't really tell right from wrong anymore. And the doctor responds to say, well, I think that's good because you're open-minded to what's really going on. The line kind of does her a bit of a disservice, because I think one of the things that Donna is great at is absolutely understanding what's right or wrong instinctively in situations. But what it does is it nicely turns the table, I think, on that early conversation where she thinks the doctor is accusing her of being quite closed-minded and naive about these things, but actually in the end she's beginning to realise that she's got something really to offer here in terms of this partnership. And I like to see that development and within the episode. I thought it was really effective.
I mean, I guess what doesn't happen is that we don't get Tennant turning to the camera and saying, and incidentally, here's a message to all of you at home. You know, obviously that's what we are supposed to take away, but we're allowed to do the deduction ourselves.
Yeah.
I found it really affecting and a little bit nihilistic when Donna said, I wanted to see the universe and I thought it was going to be great. And I've got this Holocaust allegory and I don't like it and I want to go home. Thanks, bye.
So speaking of Tennant, remind me then, when does the Lonely God stuff really kick in? Because I was expecting it here and it wasn't evident. We saw the seeding of the Doctor Donna. We saw Soon Your Song Will Be Over, which I thought were both great. I mean, I've heard cynics say, well, RTD's idea of a story arc was just by dropping in a couple of words every episode, but I disagree with that. So when does the Lonely God
Do you mean Time or Victorious?
Time or Victorious.
Because the Lonely God thing kind of runs on all the way to everything, but it's...
New Earth is when it's first mentioned.
But Time Lord Victorious really comes in with... It's mentioned somewhere beforehand, isn't it? Or does it only cough up in Waters of Mars?
New Earth is when it's first mentioned.
What, the term Lonely God? Right, okay.
Oh, there's a sad shot of him in the rain, isn't there, with the chemicals raining down.
Haim says he's a wanderer.
When does he become too full of himself, arrogant? Is that just in the specials at the end? Because I've walked away thinking this is a theme with him. And is it not really? Is it just in those specials at the end that sees him
polished off? We all spent series two thinking that the Doctor and Rose were getting too cocky and were getting cut down to size, and they did in some respects.
That's true.
Actually, no.
I haven't watched this for ages.
No, it's alright. I just remembered it relates back to. Doesn't it come up in Fires of Pompeii? I remember discussing the fact when we did Fires of Pompeii. Right. I remember we talked about the fact that it foreshadows. There's quite a lot of foreshadowing of what will then happen in Waters of Mars.
Is it where the soothsayer daughter turns the tables on the Doctor?
Ooh, yeah, I'm going to find a transcript.
In terms of his predictions.
Oh, God. The only thing I can remember from Fires of Pompeii is there is something on your back. Welcome to Something Who, where five Doctor Who fans sit around and trying to remember what happened.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if we didn't have this panel, we'd have another panel that was doing much the same thing. So it's not entirely off-brand. The huge brain, where's it come from?
What, in evolutionary terms?
Yeah, it can't exist on its own, can it?
It was found on the... Well, they found it underneath the northern glaciers, apparently.
Yeah.
Don't get me started on the evolutionary problems with evolving a brain outside your body and evolving a third brain that's the size of a house that lives in a cave. I'm not going to go there.
Right, so basically it is, and then as a result, the story happens. We're not going to get too much into how it could have come about. Okay, that's fair.
There's no evolutionary problems with the brain outside the body. There's no problem.
Is there not?
You had a load of Ooods who were arrogant, right? And then one genetic mutation had the Ood that had its brain outside the body.
Yeah.
Accidentally coughed it into its hand.
Yeah.
And all the rest got slaughtered because
of
their
somehow
arrogance.
Having your brain in your hand was an evolutionary advantage over...
Draw sympathy, which means you don't get shot to pieces or gassed or whatever by the people who don't like the arrogant, cocky Ooods.
Yeah. And all of the angry Ooods.
Who mentioned angry?
Yeah.
Well, there must have been... Natural selection has preserved the Ooods with the brains in their hands.
Because they drew sympathy from predators.
Right, okay. So there was no Ood infighting. Because that's my worry, is that if you've got two clans of Ood and one have their brains in their hands and one have kept their brains in their heads, then the brain head ones will probably, I would have thought, survived in a battle over the brain hand ones.
Well, I mean, it's described as a hind brain, isn't it? So, I mean, maybe it's an additional brain which they've just...
Yeah, it is. Yes, the Doctor says it's the amygdala, which he mispronounces.
Yeah.
In humans, and says that it's like a lobotomy.
There are harmonious.
I told you not to. Let's just leave the brains. Let's just leave the brains outside the bodies.
Right.
In summary, they are a harmonious hive mind race who are literally singing from the same hymn sheet.
Lovely. Where does the whole red eye thing come from?
Sorry, Richard, I've just cracked the big brain.
Oh, go on then.
What happens is the drone Ooods select another Ood who they then feed some sort of drink.
Right.
And then, like the queen bee, an ood, it's the ood brain in the hand grows exponentially.
Ood jelly.
So the brain grows, the secondary brain grows, and somewhere underneath there's an ood.
An action figure.
Yeah, exactly. So I've cracked that one, Gav. Next, if you want to throw me any more, mate.
No, sorry. I think.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway,
sorry, Richard. I'm so sorry.
No. But that was more entertaining than what I was going to ask, which was, so with it in the Impossible Planet / Satan Pit, red eye is an indication that the Ood have been taken over by some other intelligence.
Yes.
Whereas in this, it just seems to be an indication that they've become more Ood-like.
Mm.
So are those two things compatible?
I think, because, I was thinking about this earlier, and I think it's possible that if you say, okay, the devil in the Satan pit was effectively taking the place of the brain, right, the contact with the giant brain, hacking into the system, and sort of because they've got their translator orbs instead of their mind brains out, and that left them vulnerable to being contacted by that. And then I think the red eye, although it's not entirely consistent in this, I don't think the idea that the red eye is always when they're in contact with the super brain thing, but we've got the idea that the super brain has been breaking through, haven't we, I think.
So your theory is that red eye is their normal state, but it's been sort of hijacked by the thing in the Satan pit.
I think to be consistent, you'd have to say it's a normal state,
right,
not always, like maybe when they're in communion with the hive brain or something like that. Maybe they have a different levels of independence and how they operate at different times. Maybe the singing keeps the red eye at bay.
Yeah,
that's very good. That's very good, Giles. I like that.
A couple of other things about the episode while we're thinking through.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that really helps the pace of the episode is at the halfway point, they create almost mini cliffhangers within the episode. And I timestamped it absolutely the halfway mark, where Donna is put in the cargo container with the red eye ood. Mm. And the 10th Doctor is chased around the hangar by the claw grabber type fairground toy. And that's just what the episode, I think, needed at that point in time. There was a bit of standing around and talking, and they find a mechanism just to inject a bit of adrenaline into the story at that point in time. And again, I like where Doctor Who uses materials that kids can relate to, that everyone can relate, I think, to that seaside pier type amusement arcade game. And David Tennant, a bit in the style of Seventh Doctor and Ace, absolutely throws himself around that hangar and makes absolutely the most he can out of the threat that takes place at that point in time. And I think things like that, where we've talked about the Sensorites and its monumental inactivity at times, here's a production team who are saying, well, there's a moment here where we can really grab people's attention in a all-action adventure kind of a way, and it absolutely delivers. And there's, battle scenes later on, but it really addresses a potential lull in that episode and almost creates, if you were to break this up into a traditional 2 25-minute episode type format, it would work really well with that as your middle cliffhanger.
Rick, I think I've read at some point that Keith Temple wrote this as 4 25-minute episodes because he didn't understand that the format had changed.
Wow.
Ooh.
I think I've read that at some point.
That's very interesting.
Someone needs to write in and tell me I've made it up. I think that's what happened. I think he was commissioned to write. Was this his only one? Was this his first one? Was it his only one?
First and only one, yeah.
He's written other stuff for Doctor Who outside the canon, so to speak, but yes, this is the only TV thing that he's written. And it says on Wikipedia that he grew up in Newcastle and as a Doctor Who fan in the 70s. So the four-part thing would gel with that.
So I think that's a really great spot.
And the overall 70s feel to the story as well.
It doesn't contradict what you said, Tim, but I wonder whether it might be you might be misremembering Temple of Drassa, the episode was described as too dark and too old school Doctor Who. He stated on the episode commentary that his early draft was, quotes it here, a 6-part serial in 45 minutes.
Let me investigate my literature.
So I don't know whether that might just be a reference to he was trying to cram too much into the space, but don't know.
Let me investigate. Also investigate.
But then the interesting thing that we haven't mentioned is that the links to Impossible Planets could have been much stronger, because at one point they were going to have Ida Scott, Claire Rushbrook's character, was going to be returning in this.
Mm-hmm.
And she was going to be on the side of, yeah, investigating what was going on with the Ood. So presumably sort of taking the part of the Friends of the Ood people and so on.
I'm glad she didn't return.
And apparently her estranged father, she would discover that her estranged father had become involved with Ood operations.
As I say, I'm glad she didn't return.
Mm.
And that's not because I don't like Claire Rushbrook.
Mm.
I think she's fantastically watchable and is great in Impossible Planet and Satan Pit. But I think there's a danger that Donna has to find some footing as a companion of the Doctor. And Donna's about to share a two-parter with Martha Jones.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
And it's just essential that she gets that breathing space with the 10th Doctor to really form that relationship. So,
yes, if they started running into,
I can see how it would have worked either way, but I think for the sake of that partnership in Series 4, it really needed the Donna to have her time with the 10th Doctor.
Has anyone come across the target book that he wrote in just last year, by the look of it, or was published last year?
I have. I feel I've even got it, but I haven't read it yet.
Right.
He read bits of it. I went to that Target Books Day thing they did.
Oh, yes.
Target Book Club. They did out at Shepherd's Bush last year, and he read the opening chapter. I think he does it all from like a variety of different perspectives and obviously expands on the story quite considerably.
Okay.
As a general point, I do like that this is one of those, and it's a genre, subgenre that I'm quite fond of, this sort of Doctor creates a revolution overnight, or triggers a revolution overnight, that little group of stories that fall into that sort of category.
There's a nice bit actually in as well, I suppose, towards the end, a nice observation that the, you know, help and still thinking about how do we keep making money. So even, you know, when he's prepared to slaughter all the Ood on the planet because they've got contaminated, but so long as they don't, you know, contaminate the supply chain or the operations further up, you know, so you sort of see the absolute ruthlessness of that operation.
Mm.
Yeah, he was going to become a logistics operator because he had all the rockets and all the cargo containers.
Yeah.
And again, very well positioned in terms of an allegory for how the corporate world works today.
It's funny, given these very well-motivated villainous characters and in the Sensorites that we've already talked about, it's a shame that Kes falls into that category of people who are just attempting to be evil for no particular reason.
Yes. Yeah.
His villainy is not earned.
Mm.
He's the archetypal motiveless Machiavellian
evil henchman.
Yeah. Mm. Where he and they really over egg it when he's doing the claw scene.
Mm. Mm.
And he's like going bananas at the camera and making noises and faces.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a shame in a way, because it undermines the quality of Tim McInerney's motivated villainous persona and the city administrator that we've talked about, whose motives are very, very clearly laid out.
Mm.
So to just get this one character, who's just one note character, that he's just a bastard and he just revels in being unpleasant, it's a shame in a way. because it doesn't live up to the quality of the rest of the characterization, especially when we get moments like we already mentioned with the having to make the decision whether to sell the Doctor out and things like that. There's much more nuance in this than that guy. That guy needs sorting out in a redraft.
So, Giles, were you just citing Pixley to me?
I'm not sure what I was citing. I was citing Wikipedia, I'm afraid. So, hang on, let me see.
Well, here we go. Temple was given the basic outline by Davies, and the writer was warned to avoid the trap of writing for Doctor Who as the show had been prior to its 2005 revival. His initial ideas had been the equivalent of compacting 6 25-minute episodes into one 45-minute programme.
Okay, that's not a million miles
which
away
suggests,
from...
Yeah. Threading through of cliffhangers, and there would be therefore one at the halfway point.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. So good spot, Rick. Yeah.
And you often find there's a turning point at the halfway. There's a at the halfway mark in modern ones, there's a reveal or some kind of plot point that everything pivots around. But yeah. Yes, good point about the actual mini cliffhanger. At that point is interesting.
Richard, do you want to move on to common themes at this point?
Yeah, I mean, if nobody has anything else to say about it, and I think we probably mined it pretty thoroughly, then we could do that.
I was going to pose a question, which is, Sensorites and the Ood are considered, I think, distant cousins in the Hooniverse, and lends itself to a natural pairing of these two stories for the purposes of Something Who. But apart from their geographical location, they turn out to be very different societies and very different motivated species. So to what extent do we think that actually this is a bit of a contrived pairing by fandom?
100%.
I don't think it was fandom. I think it was Russell himself.
It was Russell. Yes.
He said early on that he thought the Ood were distant cousins of the Sensorites, and then he decided to write this story that confirmed that.
Does it confirm it?
I guess he just liked the visual image of the Sensorites wandering around being weird with their little mental amplifier disc things and cribbed that.
Yeah, there's a common thing with sort of telepathy, sort of being able to have some connection. Yeah, it's not a big connection, but it's a slight connection.
In the Sensorites, though, I quite like that point about the idea. It seemed like a reasonably sophisticated science fiction idea that if you've got a telepathic race and suddenly someone is opened up to them completely and it drives them mad, like, you know, with John, you know, that'd be the cause of John's madness, that he's sort of heard the hive mind of the Sensorites. I quite like that. It's a nice touch.
Is it this one or the previous two-parter where the Sensphere is named as being in the same region?
It's this one. Right.
Okay. But yeah, I think the complete... it's a very superficial similarity. There's a physical similarity in that they're both a little bit Richard Smith in the hair department. And there's the telepathy, but in character and in societal structure, they're miles apart. Although we don't really know what the societal structure of the Ood is, because we've not seen them untempered with. But presumably they huddle around and sing and hold hands.
Touch each other's brains.
Well, there's a hint of the idea that both societies have sort of evolved to have built a bit around trust.
Yeah. What they need is Susan to come in and lecture
because
them
of
and
the
say,
vulnerability
you can't
that, yes.
go around trusting people. Yes. People are awful. You need to be more
specific. And yet they do actually trust the people at the end of the Sensorites, because they...
Yeah.
because they let them go off, finally.
I feel that I would be delighted with the luscious locks that some of the Censorites have. So, the Ood are definitely balder by some degree.
I thought you were
going to
talk about Carol's. You were envious of Carol's luscious locks.
Well, I mean, there's...
ever-changing hairstyle.
There are some splendid... some splendid hair on offer. Talking of links, John's hair's going silver. Tim McInerney's losing his hair. So there's hair all over the place here. There's also something in the water as well. You know, so basically,
very good.
Yeah,
nice.
Good point. From a production point of view, we've talked about production teams being reflective in both stories. It's a one-time writer, but with returning directors. And whether by accident or design, because the order for series 4, I think, chopped and changed, these are episodes that follow historicals where the companion challenges that nature of, can history be altered?
Right.
And then as a change of pace, a very futuristic story follows. I think Barbara and Donna, getting to see them side by side was an interesting comparison. And I think to an extent they're both characters that offer a really effective challenge to the Doctor, or their respective Doctors. And their respective Doctors are receptive to, in the end, to what they have to say. And the wonderful thing about doing things like Something Who is you get to suddenly see those back to back and see those in a way that perhaps you haven't watching Doctor Who in different ways. And a slightly spurious one as well, actors who we're usually used to seeing in comedy turns playing quote unquote serious roles. So Tim McInerney, Catherine Tait and Peter Glaze.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be, you know, of an age to remember old Peter Glaze, but yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Just you and me, Richard, I think.
Well, yeah. We just needed Don McLean as well, I guess, and then we'd have had the...
Yes, yeah. You don't go back to Michael Aspel.
Not on Crackerjack, no.
No.
or Eamon Andrews.
I remember Cracker Jack.
Yeah.
Cracker Jack!
But all I can remember is, who was the guy who said, I could crush a grave?
Oh.
Stu Francis.
Yeah. Mm. No, you know, Ed Stewpot. Ed Stewpot Stewart is what you want, yeah.
Yeah, he once, 1 year, started the Bolton Marathon. So I saw him in the flesh. Do you know who did it the year before him? You don't want to know.
Well, no. It'd be very bizarre if we did.
Great going. Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah.
Nice.
Just an instinct.
On that bombshell.
Yeah. And of course, there's a mix of xenophobia and exploitation in both of them, but that kind of is a... we've discussed that all the way through. So, there's definitely a parallel in the stories from that.
In the Planet of the Ood, the Doctor says, when looking for the resolution to the story, he says something along the lines of it must be in a cave. Must be in a cave or something.
Oh, right. Very good.
Which I like to think is a reference.
Yeah.
We've got a traitor behind enemy lines.
Oh, yes.
I'm going to say, without bothering to check, that it's the first rocket sort of spaceship in the new series, as well as the first rocket spaceship in old Doctor Who.
What about the big rocket at the end of season 3? The big rocket with all the humans in.
Yeah. That was that kind of spaceship that took out Big Ben, wasn't there?
It wasn't a rocket, though. It was a disc-shaped oddity.
But Gav, what about the rocket?
The Impossible Planet has one.
The rocket in Utopia, that's what I'm talking about. That's a big rocket, isn't it?
Yeah. But I don't remember that.
Yeah. And I mean, if the Sensorites aren't identical, then the Ood are. Or are they? Or am I just being racist there?
No, they're literally from the same mold.
Yeah, okay.
You'll be able to do something whizzy with your editing here, Richard.
Yes,
he won't know.
I don't think you need to.
Well, maybe not.
This is all staying in.
Well, great. There is one thing I wanted to say about the Sensorites, right, which we didn't say.
Go on.
Which is, we maligned Ian for having very little to do in the Sensorites, but my goodness me, does he take a coughing routine to the absolute maximum before he keels over at the end of episode 3.
Yeah.
And I genuinely rewatched episode 3 because I couldn't quite believe myself that he started coughing about halfway through that episode and kept it up until the end. It's not quite the Fast Show, but it's a pretty good effort. He should be commended for it.
But what's strange is it starts off so underplayed and so naturalistic. You just think it's a cough by the actor. But yeah, it's terrific.
Mm.
We wouldn't have had magic like that had we not sat down to watch Sensorites.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've enjoyed the exercise so much, Richard. I think it's been really great. I've got a newfound appreciation of the Sensorites, and I really enjoyed a wave of nostalgia about that golden age for me of the new show. Yeah, I've really enjoyed both of them.
Yeah, I think it was undeniably a golden age. It was sort of a more innocent times, perhaps. Okay, well, look, thanks for listening to Something Who. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, rate and review our podcast, which you can do on Apple Podcasts or in other places if you wish. There's plenty more that's like this. I mean, you know, maybe if you've struggled through to this point, you might doubt the sanity of listening to more like this. But if you've loved it, then there's plenty more like this to find on our feed. So while you're waiting for us to do something else, do check that out. If you like Something Who, please tell your friends, your family, your colleagues, your neighbours, and all your domestic servants, even if they are looking at you a bit funny. But if you hate us, don't tell a soul. And we're intending to make new Something Who recordings about once a month, but it is just a fun thing we do in our spare time, so be patient with us if it takes a bit longer. We hope to be back soon with more thoughts on Doctor Who, old and new. And that just really leaves me to thank our panel tonight. So thanks, Tim and Gav and Rick and Giles.
Hello.
It's been great chatting with you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Doodles. Goodbye.
Bye.
See you in 2025, Something Who. Lovely.
Boom.
To up his villainy again, to give a superficial justification to...
Sorry, the cat's just walked across the keyboard. No, I can't.
He's still with us.
You're still with us. Back. Didn't hear anything.
Right.
Yeah, so I think I got my point in. it'll be there. It'll be there.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's all right. Sorry.
I'm going to put him out. Sorry.